Do you ever wonder why people behave the way they do, or why you behave the way you do? Today, I'm talking with Dr. Sarah Hill, author of Where Did You Learn to Behave Like That? A coaching guide for working with leaders. So stay tuned, because we're going to be exploring how your own story and narrative influences the way that you are today. And press subscribe right now so you can tune into every episode. If you want to find out more about how you can improve your relationships, head over to therelationshipmaze.com. Welcome to this episode of The Relationship Maze. And today I'm really delighted to be talking with Dr. Sarah Hill. Dr. Sarah Hill is co-owner of Dialogics and is based in the UK. Her early career in a range of different sectors formed the basis for the work that she does today as a dialogue facilitator and behavioural dynamics interventionist. The focus of this work is on tackling some of the toughest and most demanding behavioural challenges. She's also led the design and development of training in this field that's accredited by the International Coaching Federation. Through her experience as a supervisor of coaches and practitioners, she's been described as the consultant's consultant. So welcome, Sarah.
Hi, well, thank you for inviting me. It's good to be here and good to have a conversation with you.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm so glad to have you on the show because, as I mentioned to you before the podcast, I found out about you when I read your book, Where Did You Learn to Behave Like That? A coaching guide for working with leaders. And I just loved that book. It was such a rich book and gave me an insight into ways of working with coaching that I just hadn't come across before.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's a number of things that it offers in a way, or that the model offers to coaches is, and what underpins it is that it's offering a relational model to coaching. It's kind of saying that the relationship between the coach and the coachee, or the story guide and the story sharer, is really important.
Yeah, and that's really wonderful. And for me, that also, when I was reading that, it crosses over one of those boundaries that sometimes coaching programs or therapy programs make it such a distinction between coaching and therapeutic interventions. And for me, that I love the way that this kind of it crosses through that sort of grey area and really addresses that relational aspect.
Yes, I think understandably, historically, coaches have been really concerned about doing deep work with their clients because of this fear around that they're in some way entering the territory of therapy, and they're not equipped to do that, not trained to do that, don't have a model for doing that, and so on. And yet at the same time, I would say that if you're in a room with a client, whether that's a leader or whatever the context is for the coaching, then you're in the room with their childhood story. So that was definitely one of the drivers in wanting to write the book, was in part because I found myself in that position with my own clients over and over and over again. And yet I couldn't find any model at that time that gave me any guidance for how to do that deeper work safely, but being really clear that it was coaching and not therapy. Not that, by the way, I'm not a critic of therapy, because I think therapy is really important, and I've benefited from it myself over the years. It's more about providing coaches with a model for being able to do that work around childhood story and the part that plays in people's behavioural reactivity in their leadership, and to be able to do that effectively.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. I'm wondering, would it be possible to maybe describe an example? I realise sometimes we can't talk about specific people, but would it be possible to give an example of how this approach can benefit people or kind of enable people in a quite a unique way?
Yeah, sure. And because it has there's a behavioural component to it, that's its focus is on behaviours. Part of the model that we draw on is David Cantor's model around structural dynamics, which gives a way to be able to read the room or read what's happening behaviorally. So that's quite a key part of the approach, in being able to, if you like, sort of code some of the stuck patterns that people get into behaviorally when they're interacting with others. So an example that we might see would be, let's say, an individual who is not always the first person to speak in a room, tends to listen more, tends to stay on the periphery of the conversation, tends to wait to speak, likes to summarize, likes to bridge competing views, those kinds of things. We would describe that behavior as a bystand, so somebody who is bystanding the conversation. Now, that's an important vocal act, and no better or worse than somebody who is a stronger mover, say, so someone who sets a lot of direction in the conversation, and so on. Speaks first, advocates rather than inquires, and so on. But sometimes what can happen is people get stuck. And if you take the example of the bystander, if you become a stuck bystander, and then conditions in the environment mean that you're perhaps not even vocalizing your bystand, you've become a silent bystander. One could just coach that individual around, well, speak sooner, say more. You know, those kinds of things. And that might, if you like, resolve some of the issues that person might be experiencing. However, actually, if they're really stuck as a bystander, there it becomes possible to kind of say, well, okay, so where did you learn to behave like that? It's almost like bringing that question in some way, shape or form to say, well, to do a bit of a deeper exploration around what's happening for the person. How is it that they are finding themselves slow to speak, or just really struggling to be the person that's advocating in the room or whatever it might be. And so there you might discover a childhood story and a set of old internal narratives that got laid down around only speak when you're spoken to. Only speak if you have something important to say. So they're old internal narratives that got laid down as a result of childhood experience that may have served the child well back then, but are not serving the adult well right now in terms of how they're interacting. I'll pause there to see, because I've said quite a bit. See how does that resonate for you as you hear me describe that?
Yeah, that for me is so important, because I trained as a psychotherapist in the early 90s, and I got into coaching in mid 90s before there really were kind of many coaching trainings here, if any. And again, that was one thing that was so lacking. It was very much working now, and almost people were discouraged from exploring the story or kind of, you know, where things came from. And I think that that's such an important part. So sometimes we need to have that flexibility to explore these things, to help the person to help enable people in the way that they want to be. I'm curious as well, with exploring the story, how does that tie up with helping that person make the changes that they want to?
Yes, I'm really glad you asked that question, because of course the purpose is to enable change, or to walk alongside the person as they make changes, expand their behavioural repertoire, expand their behavioural range, and so on. So in terms of the model, I mentioned that we might explore the childhood story, the childhood experience. Particularly with a focus around, again, David Cantor would describe this as imperfect love. So this idea that we all have a childhood story of imperfect love, and it's those moments, it's those experiences that then, in my model, kind of lead to what I called this old internal narratives that about the self that get laid down. And they are often quite harsh, quite punitive, quite absolute. So for example, one of mine would be to oppose or be opposed is dangerous. Now, that comes from a childhood story, my own childhood story, around growing up in a family where I experienced abuse. So as a child, opposing and being opposed was dangerous. So in a way, that the fact that I had that old internal narrative back then was really useful. It was really helpful. It was really important. But then fast forwarding to being an adult and being a team coach and so on, where a big part of the work often is to help teams bring their conflict and bring opposition to the fore in the room, I'd find myself at times having quite a high stakes reaction in those moments. And then having done a whole load of work to help a team bring their differences into the room, I'd find myself inadvertently doing things to close it back down again. So the work to do in terms of changing that is about writing a new internal narrative. I now have a new internal narrative, which is about opposition being a critical and fundamental vocal act that is really important, and. Now, on the one hand, I'm making it sound really linear and really straightforward. So explore the childhood story, identify the old internal narratives. There'll be multiple ones. There'll be multiple old internal narratives that may be playing out. And then step three, write the new ones. But of course, it's not quite like that. You know, it's not as linear as it sounds. You know, there's lots of twists and turns to it. And the reality is that in some ways it is simple, it's far from easy to actually then live the new internal narratives. But that's the new work to do. If I've always had an old internal narrative about not having worth or not being good enough, say, to just say, well, okay, so the new internal narrative is going to be that I am good enough, I do have value, I am worthy. There's quite a bit of work to do to really embody that, to believe that, to integrate it, and so on.
Yeah, and that is what I think one of the biggest challenges I've seen with a lot of coaches is helping somebody to embody that new belief or that new reality, which because it's very easy to say this is what you need to believe, but actually how does the change happen? And that's it's such a difficult thing to describe how the process actually works. And for me, I mean, you know, sometimes I think exploring a narrative can be so powerful. And also life experiences, I find, sometimes can rewrite our own story. Like for me, when my son was born, previously I had some of my past story, past narrative would have had quite a lot of what you might label as negative connotations or negative beliefs. But somehow when my son was born, it felt like the whole world actually changed. A lot of these stories just changed in that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true. And if you think about my own experience, my own history that I've shared. I spent I spent 5 years working in the criminal justice system as a consultant, as a coach, as an organizational coach, working in prisons. So given that I've got this history around opposition and being opposed, being challenging, and yet then I find myself in a situation where, you know, because of the environment itself, there is naturally a lot of opposition, so those kinds of experiences can also really contribute to the writing of new internal narratives, of kind of saying, actually, no, there's something else here. There's a different way of being. There's an alternative way, and that could be any sort of life event: the birth of a child, an important relationship, a work context, an academic achievement, any of those things. And all of those things, I think, can potentially contribute to the writing of the new internal narrative. But of course, you know that. You can also flip that and say that any of those experiences can also reinforce the old internal narratives. So there is a degree of discipline, of rigor. You know, this is tough work to do. It's hugely rewarding and potentially transformational, but it's not soft and fluffy. It's not, which is, sometimes it has, you know, there's a view that exists that it is that way, but it's the opposite of that. It's really quite tough.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fascinating what you say. I've had experience myself with my childhood sort of developing really an aversion to conflict, doing everything I could to avoid conflict. Mm. And I ended up doing volunteering work in a sector where I had to face conflict directly myself as well. And I have to say, I never felt comfortable doing that. It was only through other work that I began to get through that challenge for myself. So even using sort of more behavioral techniques where I kind of have exposure to the situations that I find really difficult, that itself never made the difference. And I think that's where, you know, exploring the story becomes so important, that we do need to go deeper quite frequently.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love what you just said, because it's listening to that kind of feedback and being able to, kind of say, no, actually, there's something more going on here. Certainly, that was the case, you know, when for me around the opposition, was like, you know, people could tell me to oppose and tell me how to oppose till they were blue in the face, but would I do it? I recognized over time that I needed to do that deeper work, and I would say that today, in some ways, in terms of my consulting work and coaching work, I'm known as somebody who can work really effectively with teams who are experiencing a lot of difference. They're struggling to navigate their difference. There's conflict. There's relationship breakdown, and so on going on. So actually, the thing that that can sometimes be the most challenging dynamic for us behaviorally can become the thing that we become known for in terms of the expertise that we bring to that. However, I think that's only possible if we're willing to roll up our sleeves and do the work on ourselves to be able to do that. And that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other aspect that I think ties in so nicely with that, which you described, is the relational aspect. Again, so when I'm working with clients therapeutically, if a client's never experienced a trusting relationship or a relationship where a warmth or even a sense of, if they never experienced love as a child in a way that was appropriate for them, it's sort of how you bring that into that environment in terms of the relationship between, well, in this case, coach and client. I'm just wondering how you work with that.
Mm. Yeah, the relationship is fundamental. It's like the foundation, in my view, for doing this deeper work. In my book, I wrote about holding out your hand. So it's almost like the coach holds their hand out, you know, metaphorically, and walks alongside the client as they do the work. And there is a deep knowing that is very special, actually, in doing that work together with someone. Perhaps controversially, maybe not so much these days, but in the book, I talk about love and there being love, love having a place in coaching, and I'm not talking about romantic love or in that way, but I'm talking more about love in the sense of deep knowing. And so, yeah, I don't know if that kind of raises any questions for you hearing me say that.
Well, I think recently, actually, we did a podcast on the seven different types of love that the ancient Greeks used, or were as the labels of love. And I think that actually kind of helps, that we often tend to think as love as one thing, but I think the different distinctions can be so useful. So they talk about, I'm just trying to remember the name, so agape, which is a love for everybody. So it's a selfless love that you extend to other people. So in it sometimes thought as a gift love, so a universal loving kindness in Buddhism. And then there's a different type of love, pragma, long-standing love, which is more often between long-established couples. It might involve that sort of trust, the relationship, patience and tolerance. And I think for me, from how you describe that, it may be the elements of those could be a way to kind of maybe think about some of that relationship. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm interested to read more about that. I think that the relationship with love is also critical. So in the way that you were describing that, you know, it's surprising sometimes how many people haven't experienced parental love, say. And so in some ways then the coach can represent that in the relationship. And I suppose there it's important to be clear about boundaries, to again be clear about what you do and what you don't do as a coach in raising the questions of love and so on. But I think some questions that I will often explore with clients are around do you see yourself as lovable? Do you know how to be loved? Do you know how to love? Those kinds of things. So I think love as a theme plays its part in the relationship. And of course, at the same time, we have to watch out for things like projection, transference, those kinds of things, to be clear about what the relational boundaries are. The deep knowing is one-sided in some ways, in that as a coach you develop a deep knowing of that individual that you're working with, and although I believe there is a place for almost like the use of self in coaching, it's always going to be a bit one-sided, even if you are someone who is comfortable and works very proactively with self and so on in service of the clients that you're working with.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I really love the way you describe that relational aspect. I think that's so important. And also you're kind of being clear about setting the boundaries. And I think boundaries really give confidence in the relationship, and a confidence that if we're not clear with boundaries, I think it's even with young children. I think when there aren't some boundaries, children often end up becoming more anxious as adults, because it gives you sort of a confidence in terms of some of that structure. We need it's in sort of attachment theory as well. I think when we're more securely attached, you know, we feel safer to go beyond those things that might make us feel a little uncomfortable, just to be challenged a little bit and be more confident. And that often comes from having appropriate boundaries set in the first place. And I'm wondering as well, with the work that you do, what would you say might be some of the biggest challenges that that you faced or somebody else has faced in using this approach with clients?
I would say initially it's getting out of your own way. For me, it was that way. It was kind of getting out of my own way in terms of being willing to go there, being willing to dare to ask a client about their childhood story. So, you know, not least of all because coach training, again, historically, I do think it's changing. I see it changing. But historically, as you were saying, coaches have been instructed, if you like, not to go to the past, you know, to stay in the here and now and to stay future focused. And so it's understandable that there would be concern or hesitation or fear even about daring to draw on the past or look to the past to help with the work that is being done around the here and now and the future. And so I think there's, you know, that's acted as a block or a barrier, and therefore a real challenge to coaches willing to go there. So I think as coaches we have to do work on ourselves too. If we're going to do this work with others, we have to do that work on ourselves. And whilst that's common good practice in therapy, I don't think, again, historically it's been the case in coaching so much, although again I see that changing. So I think that getting out of our own way and being willing to dare to go there, I think that's a significant challenge. I can still remember the first time I asked a very senior leader about his childhood story, and my heart rate was at about 180. I thought I might pass out if I wasn't careful. But actually, you know, it was he was more than happy to answer the question and explore. I wasn't asking the question for the sake of asking the question. I was asking it because we were going round and round and round and round some behavioural patterns. And there was clearly more to it than was obvious or was evident on the surface. So I haven't yet encountered anybody when I've asked the question or inquired who's kind of not wanted to go there. Actually, I think people, including individuals and teams, actually are sometimes more willing to go there than we might realise, with the right conditions, of course, and the right environment. So I think that's
a great way of putting it, because again, I can imagine some time ago when I was doing more coaching in the corporate environment, suddenly bringing up childhood would be, I can imagine my heart pounding doing that, because it just seems such a different environment, and you're thinking, well, I just have to focus on business, the sort of coaching in this context, and you know, that could be really challenging. And I like the way you say a lot of the time we get in our own way. So that's such an important thing to explore that ourselves.
Yeah, and what I just added on the end there about, you know, in the right conditions, in the right environment. So it's not about just childhood story work isn't like a tool in a toolkit that you kind of just like, oh, okay, and just pull that tool out and drop that question into a team session or an individual session. It is, you know, that there is a model and a process for doing it, and you know, building the container, there being trust, there being really clear about purpose around why you're not doing it for the sake of doing it. It's going there with a purpose. A team where the relationships are breaking down, you'll see a lot of shadow behavior. So that behavior that we are least proud of in ourselves, that's usually a sign that the childhood stories are in the room in those moments. And so if a team is up for doing the deeper work because they really want to, they want to be able to navigate their relationships more effectively, improve their performance and so on, then we would contract around doing that and then set to work. It's not just about sort of randomly dropping it in, because yes, that could potentially do more harm than good.
Absolutely. And for me, one of the things that I think helped me really be more open to exploring my story, when I first started kind of exploring this many years ago, was in the sort of mid-90s, I went on an NLP course, neuro-linguistic programming. And one of the sort of what are called presuppositions there is that behind every behavior is a positive intention. So basically all of these stories we learn in the past, at one time they served us, whether it's for protection, defense, So now, whatever somebody's experiencing, whether it's a phobia, whether it's some behavior which really seems to be getting in the way of their lives now, at some point, this had a purpose, it had a function. And as we go through life, sometimes that old pattern that's established just doesn't work anymore. And I think just, and sometimes a concept of thinking, well, you know, every behavior has that positive function originally, it can be very difficult for some people to take on board. But I think having that shift can really help people to work through that.
Yes, I'm really glad you said that, because in a way, that's what makes the writing of the new internal narrative so challenging. The fact that the behavior did serve a purpose at some point. As you say, for protection, for defense, for survival sometimes. So that's you know, like, why would you give that up in a way? Except that in the here and now, as an adult, it's no longer serving you. In fact, it's doing the opposite. It's getting in the way. It's causing harm, either to the individual themselves or to other people around them.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm wondering, and it may be something that's kind of difficult to think up on the spur of a moment, but I'm wondering, is there a simple sort of a way that people could do an exercise or kind of think about narratives in their lives after listening today, some little kind of some exploration that they could do that you might suggest?
Yeah, one of the exercises you can do to really just begin to link the present to the past is a really nice exercise, actually. It's to think back to childhood. And so actually it's perhaps important to say that when we talk about childhood, we're thinking about birth right the way through adolescence, so to about the age of 23, 24. So sometimes childhood makes one think of, you know, the younger years, but actually it's right the way through adolescence. So to sort of allow yourself to reflect back through your childhood years and think about the people that you loved and that you admired in some way. And they could be family members, they could be it could be world leaders, it could be somebody from popular culture, anybody really, but people that you admired, and really reflect on what it was about them that you loved and that you admired. What were the characteristics that you saw, that you experienced, that you really appreciated? And then from there, take your reflection into the ways in which you share those characteristics and those attributes today through your own leadership. And so it's a lovely exercise to do. And what it does is it just helps you to begin to make that connection between the present and the past. And then another one I would say would be to think about, reflect on a time when you've had a really big high stakes reaction. You've kind of walked away from a conversation or an interaction where you just wish the floor had opened up, or you just wish you'd handled it differently. And just very gentle, very light touch, just journal, reflect on what some of those behaviours were. And then ask yourself that question. So where did I learn to behave like that? Where does that come from? And can you allow your mind to just, again, gently just wander back to what the source of some of those behaviours might be, and what old internal narratives got laid down as a result. So reflection is really, you know, it's a key part of the practice. So there's a couple of things that you could do, or that people could do.
That's wonderful, thank you. And I'm wondering, as we get towards the end of this episode, if there's anything that I haven't asked you or anything you'd like to say that before we begin to wrap up.
I think the main thing, it's come through actually in our conversation together, but I think by way of drawing our conversation to close, I just want to say that the one of the core purposes around doing this work is from my perspective, it's about reducing the harm that we otherwise can cause, either to ourselves or to others around us. And for those of us who are in leadership positions, that just seems so critical, so fundamental, that we can do that, and that we're willing to do that, and that we're up for doing that.
Absolutely. And how could people find out more about you or get in touch with you if they want to kind of explore more about this?
So we've got a website, which is www.dialogics.co.uk. And there's a contact point there. There's actually lots of blogs on that website, which might be of interest, and some articles and posts and things. So, you know, that's a resource as well. But yes, if you go to the website, and then you can contact me from there.
Great. And thank you so much for being a guest today. It's been really wonderful speaking with you.
I've loved our conversation. Thank you for inviting me again. I think a key goal for me is to have people talking and thinking about childhood story work. And so this podcast is part of that. So I really appreciate you inviting me to do it.
No, that's great. Thank you so much. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.